are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people who make them and do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates or advertisers.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Wherever you are,
let's turn that audio off. Welcome to the show, whoever you are, wherever you are. All around this gorgeous planet we call Earth, thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my very distinct pleasure to say to you, Happy New Year. We are now no longer in the year of 2008. We are now in 2009, and lots of folks thought we wouldn't make it, but we did, didn't we? And Happy New Year, wherever you are on this planet. Some of you are joining us for the first time tonight. Welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. Hope you make a habit out of it. It's a good habit to get into. A couple of quick updates on some information here that I think are pretty important. I've talked about these previously, the sort of little bit of debate going on between NASA and the Obama transition team. And we've already talked about that a little bit, the fact that the Obama transition team apparently is of the opinion that military rockets could be used to send astronauts back to the moon sooner and cheaper than the building of the Ares-1 rocket, which is, of course, what the plan is right now. It's already underway. So that's continuing. The NASA administrator, Michael Griffin, says, he continues to say that the military rockets were built to launch satellites into space, and number one, don't have enough muscle to launch the new space capsule that will be used, and number two, they're not safe enough for human consumption, if you will. So that'll be interesting to watch and see how that goes. If he is not reappointed by the incoming administration, Michael Griffin's tenure at NASA comes to an end on January 20th. So it'll be interesting to watch and see. All right, now China. You know, we talk about China's entry into the space race quite often here on the show. And, I mean, they are really moving forward rapidly. Well, now they are going to build a new radio telescope. This new radio telescope is going to be the size of 30 football fields. Its overall capacity will be 10 times larger than the world's largest radio telescope, which is Arecibo, built by the United States or developed by the United States, currently the largest. The new one, built by China, will be the largest, and it is slated to begin operation in 2013. One of the things that it will be able to do, in addition to astronomy, will be, it says it can also be a highly sensitive passive radar to monitor satellites and space debris, which would be greatly helpful for China's ambitious space program. The telescope could also help to look for other civilizations by detecting and studying communication signals in the universe. So that will be interesting to watch and see what happens there. We'll be back in just a moment with my guest this evening, Stanton Friedman. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I said, my guest this evening is Stanton Friedman, and it's always a pleasure to have him with us. It has been quite some time since you've been with us, Stanton. Welcome back to the show.
Well, glad to be on again, of course, especially to start off a new year. So Happy New Year, Kevin.
And Happy New Year to you, too. I hope you have a great year.
I'm looking forward to it.
You've been busy since you were with us last. You just don't let grass grow under your feet, do you?
Well, I try not to. I mean, life is moving on rapidly, and the older you get, the faster it moves, which doesn't make any sense to me, but that's the way it seems to be. So get it done while you can, because who knows how much longer you have, you know. So I'm working on another book package, and I've got conferences coming up, and possible television commitments on a series, maybe. Who knows? Don't know yet. But I'm an optimist, you know. And it's going to be a great year.
Well, that's good. We've got things happening here that make it look like this might be a great year for us, too. And that's a good thing. Let's just sort of do something that's almost typical for the end of a year. We've just finished 2008. We're beginning 2009. And when you look back, not just on 2008, but over several decades now of doing UFO investigation, what do you consider to be the most important evidence that you've come across for the reality of extraterrestrial intelligent life?
Boy, you know, which kid do you like the most? What kind of a question is that?
Best one I could come up with.
Several different things come to mind. One is obviously Roswell. I'm the original civilian investigator of the Roswell incident, and I know it's popular among the nasty, noisy negativists to attack Roswell for not good reasons. And, you know, I don't know whether you know it or not, I was on a rerun last night of a Larry King show that I did last July with Bill Nye, the science guy, and Seth Shostak. I didn't know it was going to be on, but I found out at the last minute, so I watched some of it. And, you know, here are people saying there's nothing to any of this stuff. And Roswell got me in trouble this past year, incidentally. We'll come back to that later, but not in trouble, but some people gave me a very hard time because of it, for no good reason, but we'll talk about it.
All right.
The other thing that comes to mind is MJ-12, and I know people will tell you that's all a mess. And, you know, I keep hearing people just casually say, well, everybody knows those documents are fraudulent. And these aren't people who researched them. They've read a couple of other people who said the documents were fraudulent. And I was thinking how much digging I've done and how many things I find out, have found out that weren't known before. And how, yes, I've shown a number of so-called MJ-12 documents are fraudulent, but it's the ones that aren't that matter. You know, mm-hmm. Here's about the phony ones. I think those will turn out to be, finally, when people get away from their snits about not liking it, the MJ-12 documents, and the same with Roswell. You know, I've got review chapters on both of these in Flying Saucers and Science, and I noticed in a review out of England that he liked a guy, Peter Brooksmith, as a matter of fact, wrote the review, and he liked some things in there, like how to get to the stars and stuff, but he seemed to be irked that I even was talking about Roswell or MJ-12 update. I mean, everybody knows they're fraudulent, was his attitude. Well, he didn't give any reasons, no facts, no data, no information, but everybody knows, and you're supposed to buy that, you know. Real strange. And also, I feel a major contribution has been my work on the star map connected with the Betty and Barney Hill case. And there are people tell you that's all baloney, too. And there was another attack that was made this past year. It's been a busy time the last few months. You know, the focus on Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli, a unique pair of sun-like stars that are only 39.3 light-years away from us, which is just down the street, and are only an eighth of a light-year apart from each other, and a cool billion years older than the sun, well, that gives you a whole new perspective about what the situations would be for beings around one of those, on a planet around one of those stars, looking over at the other star compared to our situation out here in the boonies. So that's an important contribution, and controversial, of course. And I suppose along the way I've done more to publicize the results of Project Blue Book's Special Report 14. And, you know, when you start talking to the noisy negativists, as I call them when I'm being polite, you find they've never looked at it, the SETI people in particular. There is no evidence for UFOs. No credible evidence for UFOs, whatever word you want in there. But if you look at their books and their articles, they never mention large-scale scientific studies like Blue Book Special Report 14. Well, I mentioned in every lecture. And the first chapter, of course, in Flying Saucers and Science goes over five large-scale scientific studies. And I have very often asked, how many people have read this one as I go over these at the beginning of my lectures? It's fewer than 2%. And you can't find them at all. So I think my focus on evidence, and that, after all, is a government-sponsored study, and the work was done by Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio, not a UFO group. And isn't it nice how we can sidestep all the evidence and go on to research by proclamation? Well, you know, I'm a hard-nosed son of a gun and in-your-face kind of guy, but I'm trying to get other people to realize that being an apologist ufologist or a closet ufologist is not constructive. It doesn't do anything for anybody. It saves somebody from trouble. And, you know, I've had 11 hecklers in over 700 lectures. Wow, you get that many if you're talking about, well, you pick the topic, religion, sports, politics. I'm sure you get more than that hecklers, you know, if you talk about those subjects. 700 lectures, 11 hecklers, no big deal. So I'm trying to get people to recognize that it's time to stand up and be counted. So I'm charging, in other words. Let's get on with it, guys. Let's not sit back and hope that someday somebody will drop, you know, the enormous evidence in our laps and we won't have to do anything. We won't have to stick our necks out. Well, you know, what's wrong with sticking your neck out? If you've got the facts in hand, might as well put your mouth in gear. Somebody has to.
Well, yeah, you know, but look, people tend to hear what they want to hear regardless of what you say or what you write. I have some personal experience with that. And
don't always get it right, huh?
No, it's not only people that are supposed to be sort of in the same camp you're in, but people that are on the outside. You know, some alleged expert makes a statement that, well, those have been proven to be false, like the MJ-12. They've been proven to be frauds. So they make that statement, do not provide the proof, but then because that's what people want to hear, they pick up on it, and then they start repeating it as if that's the gospel. And, you know, they're not only wrong, they're dead wrong. But
yeah.
It becomes, see, it then grows into, well, everybody knows this. Well, anything that everybody knows is usually a tsunami of crap.
Well put. I like that, tsunami of crap.
Well, it's unsophisticated, but it's very real. I mean, everybody knew the Earth was flat, right? Everybody knew that all of the stars and
the moon.
All the stars and the planets all revolved around, orbited us, right? Everybody knew that.
Sure.
Well, let me ask you another question now. This one is, we've looked back a little bit. Let's look forward a little bit. Now, you're a nuclear physicist, and not only that, you're one of a handful who have actually worked on the development of atomic-powered rocket engines.
Yep.
What's the deal? Why is NASA, after all these years, still lighting a fire to chemicals in the tail end of a rocket?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I wish I had an answer for it. I think it's a lack of courage. To put it simply as I can, you know, in contrast to NASA, we had Admiral Rickover, Hyman Rickover, and he was the man behind the nuclear navy, the nuclear submarines, and eventually nuclear power plants and nuclear-powered aircraft carriers and stuff like that. And he had to fight off the battleship boys and all the people who said you couldn't do that. And, you know, what good would it be if you had it so you can stay underwater? And, you know, soon the Polaris missile came around, so they realized, ooh, maybe there is something good to be able to stay under the water for, you know, a couple of years if you want to go around the planet without surfacing and all this kind of stuff. But he had a goal. He was very much goal-oriented, made sure all the people that were on the program with him were goal-oriented. And when it comes to the nuclear rocket program, they have a long history. I mean, I worked on it in the 60s. I worked on two different kinds of nuclear rockets besides nuclear airplanes. And the problem in all three areas, four altogether, but was a lack of leadership and somebody who knew what he wanted to do and how to get there. And it was kind of extraordinary. We tested nuclear rocket engines on the ground. The biggest one, I worked at Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab in Pittsburgh. We tested the NRX-A6. Less than 6 feet in diameter. There's a picture of it in my book, Flying Saucers and Science. And power level was 1,100 megawatts. Now, the power level of Grand Coulee Dam is about 2,000 megawatts, and it's very large. This thing was 6 feet in diameter. Los Alamos built the Phoebus 2B nuclear rocket reactor propulsion system and operated it on the ground for at a power level of 4,400 megawatts, twice the power of Grand Coulee Dam. That was about 7 feet in diameter, so it was a little larger. But that's an awful lot of power in a small package, I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm.
This is back in the 60s, mind you. And the reason that I say they were lacking leadership, I attended a meeting at Aerojet General, which was the other group that was involved. They built more flight-type systems, the XE-1. That was only 1,000 megawatts. That's a lot of power. I was at Aerojet, and I got asked, I was working on radiation shielding for these things, and my counterpart at Aerojet said, "Hey, Stan, you want to go to a meeting? The NASA Space Nuclear Propulsion Office was having a meeting, and the purpose of the meeting was to discuss what should we do with a nuclear rocket engine." I said, "Sure, I'd love to go." So, okay, I'm there. It was the saddest meeting I've ever been to. They provided not leadership, but, gee, what are we going to do with this thing? And, well, we could use it to set up a base on the moon or from Earth orbit to lunar orbit or maybe to go to Mars as an upper stage. A nuclear rocket has more than twice the specific impulse, miles per gallon, if you want to put it that way, of a chemical rocket. And they didn't know what they wanted to do with it. And when you don't know what you want to do, you lose funding, and the program ended a couple of years later because they didn't have a job, a goal. And NASA has been lacking goals. I mean, ever since President Kennedy said, let's get a man to the moon and back safely by the end of the decade, that was way back in like 61, and we did it in 69, they haven't had goals. And it was really strange to me that 30 years after that meeting, would have been at least 30 years, maybe a little more than that, I was at a conference on a panel in Cocoa Beach, Florida, right near the Kennedy Space Center. And there was a guy on the panel from NASA, and he was very pleased about the fact that they're considering the possibility of perhaps using nuclear power to go to Mars. And all I could think of was, gee, that'd be great, but it's 30 years late. So I don't know what the problem is, whether they don't have guts enough. They're scared. Oh, my goodness, it's nuclear. Wow, radiation. I mean, gee whiz, why does anybody drive a car? That gasoline is explosive as can be. You could burn your house down. It's a risk most of us are willing to take. So can they be made safe? Sure they can. Might there eventually be an accident? Of course. We've lost two shuttles, after all. That didn't stop us from going out into space. So I don't know why. Now, the much bigger boom for a rocket is from a nuclear fusion rocket. And fusion is what goes on in the sun.
Well, before we get into that, let me ask you about what you were working on. Now, what you were working on, could it be used as a launch vehicle, or do you have to get it up into space and then use it as a second stage, as they were talking about?
Well, probably a second or third stage. It makes a big difference if you got a powerful third stage, though.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the amount of payload you can put into orbit or off to Mars or any place else you want to go. It's safer, you know, we have to recognize you launch from a facility. If you have a launch pad accident, you don't want a nuclear system operating full bore, 1,000 or 2,000 or 4,000 megawatts. Doesn't have a lot of thrust in comparison to, say, a Saturn V. Less than 500,000 pounds thrust, and it was 3 million for a Saturn V. But the upper stage is where you can use it the most, and it's a heck of a lot safer and all that sort of stuff. Now, the fusion is more exciting, but only if you have a goal to go to the stars. Fusion, as I said, is what goes on in the stars, and it's what goes on in H-bombs, and that scares people. It's not easy to make a bomb work, incidentally, in fission or fusion, but the point is you can kick particles out the back end of a rocket that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. Not 10, not 100, not 1,000, 10 million times as much energy per particle. Now, would it be costly? Sure. Every new development is costly, especially when you've got distant goals. You know, you want to get somewhere. You want to do something. You want to do something
special. Well, you mentioned the nuclear subs earlier, and, I mean, that whole program was immensely expensive to get it going. But now, I mean, nuclear subs are the thing. That's what we use. It's sort of the standard now.
Sure. And on top of that, it's not only the subs, the nuclear aircraft carriers.
Mm-hmm.
These are big monsters. Now, do you realize that...
Stanton, we have to take a break. We'll pick up with the aircraft carriers when we come back.
Okay.
All right, folks. Stanton Friedman, it's always interesting, always mind-bending and exciting, and this one's no different. We'll be back right after that. And welcome back. Stanton Friedman is my guest, and just before break, you were starting to say something about nuclear aircraft carriers, and I had to cut you off, so the floor is yours, sir.
Well, the point I wanted to make with nuclear aircraft carriers is that today they're designed in such a way that the reactors don't need to be refueled for 18 years. And, you know, think about that for a minute. The big thing about fleet operations, the way it used to be, of course, is getting enough oil for operating the ships in the fleet. And the aircraft carriers, normally you'd have an aircraft carrier and a cruiser and a destroyer and whatever, would carry the fuel for them. And the trouble is that in a ship, a standard ship, the faster you go, the more fuel you use per mile. And so you're restricted in your operation of your the boats, the ships, and the group by the need to be careful about how much fuel you use. Because in wartime, for example, you know, where are you going to get fuel? Not so easy. Well, 18 years without refueling means the carrier, and if you have nuclear ships with it, they can steam full tilt forever. Well, you know, days, weeks, months. And so it changes your whole mode of operation. And a lot of people don't realize that. You know, it's easy to think, well, you replace a chemical-fired big bunch of diesel generators and stuff with just a nuclear reactor. Well, it changes much more than that. So you have to think in a new way, in a new fashion, when you're talking about how you're going to operate these things. Well, the thing about fusion that I started to mention is that this is for going to the stars. Not close by, not to the sun, but our local neighborhood's got plenty of stars, a couple thousand within 50 light years or so, and about 5% of them are similar to the sun and probably have planets and life. And, you know, we're just the beginning. We found over 300 exoplanets, that is, planets in other solar systems external to ours. But the kicker is most of them are not really similar to the Earth, because our techniques aren't good enough for spotting those. We find the big ones. But within a few years, we're going to have the Kuiper spacecraft and a couple of others up there that from space will be able to observe planets around any of the stars in the local neighborhood and Earth-sized planets without much trouble. That's within a few years. So that's going to change our whole perception of how things are. Instead of being stuck with these big old monster planets, which are not very likely for life, just because of the gravitational situation and the temperatures and a whole bunch of other things. So fusion is something that every civilization out there is going to know about. Because everybody wants to know, how is it that our star is producing all that energy? You know, Lord Kelvin thought it was burning gas and it could only last for 10 million years. Well, it isn't. It's nuclear fusioning, and it'll last for another 5 billion besides the 5-plus billion it's already lasted. So you change your concepts about a lot of things. And, again, the kicker here is that it wasn't too long ago that people thought that the Earth was created, the universe, that's what they said, was created in 4004 B.C. on a Thursday afternoon. I think it was October something. Bishop Usher figured this out. So the planet hasn't been around that long. And nobody out there much older than we are, more advanced than we are, knows more than we do. Well, as we recognize that, you know, the neighborhood's a lot older than that. I mean, the Earth's 4.5 billion years old or so. Beta Reticuli, 5.5 billion years or so. And there are stars out there that are 12 billion years old, you know. And suddenly, 4004 B.C. doesn't seem very long ago, you know. And we haven't seen much evidence that man has changed much in a few thousand years. We've learned a lot, but we haven't changed intrinsically. So it gives you a different perspective, and it makes the notion of other people visiting no big deal. And I would love to have been around when the native chiefs in Central America, Dominican Islands, or that whole area that Columbus visited, you know, what their discussions were after the first visit by Columbus. You know, are these people a threat to us? Are there many of them out there? They haven't been here before, have they? What do they want from us? Are they gods? That would be neat if they would come here to help us, you know. And some of the visitors tried to pretend they were gods, didn't they?
And all of that same conversation seems to be happening relative to extraterrestrials.
That's right. That's my point, that, you know, we're suddenly realizing that, no, there's more than one galaxy. We didn't realize that until in the 1920s. One galaxy, that's all there was.
And you know what? I didn't realize that. I didn't know that it was the 1920s before we discovered there were other galaxies.
Yeah, there was a huge argument in science and a big conference where somebody had taken some really good pictures and measurements and stuff, and it turns out that those the nebula, as they were called, it turned out many of them weren't just clouds out there. They were masses of stars and a long ways away. A very long ways away. So, yeah.
So, up until then, everybody knew there was only one galaxy.
Right, right.
You see? Another tsunami of crap.
Yeah, well, there's lots of them around.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of my mantras, and I irk people by repeating it, is that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. I'm working on a new book. It's called It's Impossible, Isn't It? And looking at all the stupid things smart people have said over the years that have stood in the way of progress in medicine, in aviation, in space, there's an awful lot of smart people that said things that, you know, space travel is utter bilge. That was the British Astronomer Royal a year before Sputnik went up, you know, stuff like that. And he couldn't imagine. We ought to build better telescopes. He couldn't imagine the idea of what satellites might do, even though a Brit, Arthur Clarke, had come up with the idea, you know, for communications and stuff. It's the lack of imagination on the part of these people who were sitting at the top of the heap. Maybe it's just they don't want anybody else to join them at the top. I don't know.
Well, since we're talking about this, let me bring up an idea that I've brought up with several physicists, and so far only one has said it might be possible, and that is faster than light anything, not just faster than light travel, but is there anything faster than the speed of light? Is such a speed even possible?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. There, people have postulated the existence of tachyons, crazy particles whose existence is not prohibited by some of the equations that describe what happens with particle physics. And they would always be going faster than the speed of light. You haven't found any yet. Part of the problem is that you get time reversal, which I don't know how you handle that. You know, you get younger with time. I don't know. But the kicker here is, do you need to? Let me give you an example. You know that large Hadron Collider, that huge facility over in Switzerland there?
Yeah.
The accelerator.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to look for the Higgs boson. Now, it's had a little accident, and they need to rebuild some things. But it already has had a beam going in there. And there are two beams, really, and they're to go in opposite directions, and when you adjust things properly, they'll collide, and boy, let's see what happens, because there's an enormous amount of energy. Now, you know how fast those particles are going? 99.999999% of the speed of light.
Now, so it's essentially the speed of light.
Well, yeah, but there are implications for that. And it's funny how these are misunderstood. I point this out to people that you can't have half an Einstein. I mean, you got to, not only is the speed of light a limit, but there's some crazy things that you can take advantage of as you get close to the speed of light. Time slows down for the things moving that fast.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how much depends, and I haven't done the calculations for 99.99999, but at just 99.99, you can go like 37 light years in 6 months pilot time. Now, I want to bring up an objection that was raised by one of the noisy negativists. He says, yeah, Friedman doesn't take into account the fact that the pilot of this so-called Einsteinian spaceship will have his weight enormously increased and won't be able to move. You know, what nonsense. Well, that simply isn't true. Yes, the mass increases and the time slows down, but that's in the time frame of the observer. I don't know how you observe something going past you at the speed of light. It's not easy. He's not in view very long, you know. But no, the mass doesn't increase as far as he is concerned. The reason that's important, somebody says, oh, you're going to kick particles out. Well, it takes that much more energy to get them when you're going that fast. That's not quite true either. If you use nuclear fusion, the particles are produced. It sounds crazy. I realize that when I think about it. The particles are produced with enormous amount of energy, that 10 million times as much energy as they, for particles they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. They're not accelerated to that. The fusion process, you convert a little mass to a lot of energy, you know, equals mc squared, famous equation. That's probably the most famous equation around, I guess. And it's true, and we've established that it happens in fission from the other end. You take a big old fat uranium nucleus and captures a neutron, and it splits, fissions into several particles, and if you add up the mass of the particles compared to the original mass, hey, we converted some mass into energy. Lots of energy. Really lots of energy. And that's what makes nuclear fission work. Well, it's on the other end of the system, but fusion works too. So if you go fast, the guy moving fast, he's doing his thing, but from an outside view, he's time has slowed down for things moving that fast.
All right, now let me ask something before we get too much further away from it, something about what you said. You said that at 99.99% the speed of light, you can travel, and I was writing as fast as I could, so I may have gotten this wrong. I think you said 37 light years in 6 months.
Pilot time. 6 months pilot time.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, for the pilot, for the person piloting the craft, 6 months and he's 37 light years away.
Yeah, from his twin brother left at home, he's aged 37 years in that time. Now, that's okay. Crazy. I realize that, but that's the way it is. And people think this is all theory, the theory of relativity. Well, you darn well better take it into account when you design your accelerators and a bunch of other things.
Yeah. We have to take a break, and we'll be back right after that break. We're back, and my guest this evening is Stanton Friedman. Stanton, we were talking about this traveling at 99.99% the speed of light. During the break, another question came to mind. I hope you don't mind if I ask.
Why not?
All right, the guy standing on the ground observing this, all right, he watches someone travel one light year. He experiences 1 year. But the guy that's the pilot of that craft experiences much less time, right?
Yeah, how much less depends. I mean, I don't know how you watch something traveling a light year. That's a long way.
Speaking theoretically. If the observer experiences 1 year of time passing, but the person on the craft, the pilot, experiences maybe a few minutes or a few days, something like that.
Yes.
So if we look at it, just so that I understand what you're saying, we look at this from entirely the point of view of the pilot of the craft at 99.99% the speed of light, traveling at that speed for 6 months, he will have traveled a distance equal to around 37 light years.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the follow-up, how is it possible to generate that speed? Is that even realistic?
Well, let's go back to a couple of basics. One, at just 1G acceleration, you know, the acceleration when you drop a rock, it speeds up as it's heading toward the ground. 21 miles per hour per second, if you want it in a useful term. People will tell you 9.8 meters per centimeter squared, per second squared, which doesn't mean anything to anybody. Okay, at 1G acceleration, and I've tried this little experiment on some campuses. When I speak there, I say I'm willing to speak to classes and so forth, and sometimes the physics department decides it's going to try to show up this idiot who's talking about flying saucers, and I get a real kick out of those. But one of the things I do, of course, is talk about stuff that they don't know anything about, just so they know the prof isn't as smart as he'd like to think he is, about nuclear rockets and other things like that. But one of the questions I ask them what 1G is, and they all tell me 9.8 meters per second, and I say, how do you relate that to a Corvette? And they look at me totally blank. They have no idea about what's going on in the real world. Well, 21 miles per hour per second. So for your listeners who are car hounds, you know, if you get 0 to 63 miles per hour in 3 seconds, that's pulling 1G, and that's a hot car, real hot car.
Yeah.
And that's only 1G. Okay, and then I ask them, they all know what the speed of light is, 300,000 kilometers per second. I say, okay, what's that in real units? And they don't know, but it's 670 million miles an hour. And that 670 million miles is a distance from here past Jupiter, past Saturn. And it's still in the solar system. So in 1 hour. Okay.
That it gives a whole new meaning to, are we there yet?
Yeah, you're right. See, my question for them then is, okay, how long does it take at 1G acceleration to get to the speed of light? It's a multiple choice question. 1,000 years, 100 years, 10 years, 1 year. And I ask them, how many think it's this, how many think it's that? Well, plenty of them think it's 1,000 years. The real answer is 1 year. So it's not nearly as big a deal as some people would like to think it is. Now, okay, where do you get the energy from? Well, we can learn a lot there, too. Nuclear fusion. The nice thing about fusion is the stuff you use are isotopes of hydrogen and helium. And what's nice about is that most of the universe is hydrogen and helium. Wherever you go, you're going to find hydrogen and helium. That's what the stars are made out of, and there's plenty of this stuff around, around Jupiter, for example, and so forth. And the kicker is that when you use hydrogen and helium, you can kick these particles out, and they're going fast. Very fast, very, very fast. That's the 10 million times as much energy per particle. So you have a reasonable supply, and you start moving off. But there's another source of energy for travel, a very useful one that we all use but don't think about. When we have the Cassini spacecraft right now out around Saturn, sent back some beautiful pictures recently of Saturn's rings and so forth. Now, how did it get there? With some huge rocket? No. We sent it out in, really, closer to the sun. We sent it past Venus. And by being precise about its orbit, when it got close, Venus says, hi, Cassini, let me give you a free ride. And it bends its orbit, and it comes back, heading toward the Earth, but now it's going much faster. And when it comes past Earth, It got another free run.
Well, I don't have an explanation, folks. We will try and see if we can get Stanton back on the line here and see if we can continue. This has been happening, as you know, frequently. And at first I thought maybe there's some malfunction with the telephone system. That has not been the case because we've switched out systems and, you know, and we've switched out computers. We've done lots of stuff to try and track that down. But apparently someone doesn't want us to be able to speak with Mr. Friedman, and we're just going to have to do this a little differently. And that is, we're going to have to go to a backup here, and one that maybe somebody doesn't know about. And if you'll bear with me, I guess I should play some music, but I'm just going to go ahead with this and see what we can do here. Yeah, we're getting through.
What happened?
Stanton, welcome to my outside assistance that I get. We're on a backup system that perhaps they're not too aware of.
Oh, good.
Okay. Cassini got a free ride off of the Earth's gravity.
Well, it got first Venus.
Yeah.
Then the Earth, and then Jupiter. So if we're smart, in other words, we take advantage of Mother Nature. We've been doing that all our lives, of course, you know. And so one of the early calculations about the impossibility of getting landing on the moon, the guy assumed that the rocket had to provide all the energy to get there and to get back. And the only way when you came back was to use a retro rocket. And of course, you got to lift that up and slow it down at the moon and then lift it up from there and slow it down back here. We didn't do that. We let the moon's gravitational field pull it in. That's why there's a launch window for going to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
You fire at just the right time so that the moon, which is very reliable in its orbit, comes along at the right time and pulls you in. Freebie. Lots of freebies. So what I'm saying, any advanced civilization is going to be using, for example, a black hole in the neighborhood to give you a free kick.
Yeah.
Your own, use the sun. And use all of these. So sensible engineers, in other words, take advantage of the situation as best they can. I'll give you an example. When the original plan to go to the moon required two Saturn V monster rockets, which would be put into orbit, rendezvous near the Earth, and make up a spacecraft which would go to the moon, be launched from the moon, and then rendezvous back near the Earth.
All right, we have to go to break. We'll be back after this, and we'll see what we can do with these phone systems. I think we're going to stay with this backup system. All right, folks, we'll be back right after this. Okay, sorry for the disruption, but those things happen to us about every 2 years, and I guess it's time for the new trainees. Stanton, before we go in any further, every time you say something, it makes me think of another question. We were talking about Betty and Barney Hill and Zeta Reticuli, and it's only about a little less than what, 30, a little less than 37 light years away, right?
A little more, 39.3.
Okay. So that means that in just over 6 months, they could have been from there to here.
Yeah, well, if they crank her up to 99.999, then we cut it down even a lot more.
So what happens if you're traveling at that speed and you get hit by a piece of space junk, say the size of a marble, a dime?
Well, remember that between the stars, there isn't much space junk. There's atoms, but there ain't many marbles.
Okay.
The atmosphere, you know, or within a solar system where you'd slow down, of course, you know, you dash on the freeway or you go to Europe where they drive 150 kilometers an hour on the road, but you slow down when you're in, you know, going shopping at the mall.
Uh-huh.
So, and also they would have systems for detecting junk.
Yeah.
And you'd have electromagnetic shielding against particles. And, you know, when we first started talking about going into space, there were some noisy negativists who said, look, in the first place, man can't stand being weightless. In the second place, his brain is going to be addled. You know, in the third place, you got your meteors. In the fourth place, you got radiation. They'll never make it. Well, we got an awful lot of stuff up there, and there have been a lot of man hours and woman hours, people hours in space. And none of those things, you got to worry about them. Okay, a lot of things you got to worry about in life, you know. Your brakes better work on your car, too. But you're not saying, I'm not going to drive because my brake might fail. So you try to get the odds on your side. And, you know, again, you have to allow for somebody having had a lot more time than we have to develop their technology. I mean, the first radio transmission across the ocean was, what, 105 years ago or so. The first satellite was 1957. That's a moment in time.
Yeah.
What if these guys have been working on their stuff for a million years? Zeta Reticuli is a billion years older than the sun. Now, anybody who tells you that he knows what the technology will be limited to 50 or 100 or 500 or 5,000 or 5 million years from now is it's talking through his nose. I mean, it just, we don't know. We are ignorant. None of us is doing a very good job of predicting the future. And, you know, it's kind of aggravating about the Betty and Barney Hill case, incidentally. There's a skeptical guy named...
Well, I think we have lost... Yeah... We have lost our guest again, and so we will go to the backup system, and that means that it will be almost impossible for us to take calls, but we will try to take calls, and we'll see what happens here. This is really, really strange. It's been a long time. I mean, we have interruptions like that from time to time, but it's been a long time since we've had this much. Yeah, well, we'll just use this other system. And we will try to continue from here. You were talking about Betty and Barney Hill.
Yeah, a guy named Brian Dunning publishes a skeptical kind of thing, and he did a nasty piece on the case, and my column in MUFON Journal and UFO Magazine talks about it, but got everything wrong, which is quite remarkable. And then he gets mad because I objected on a radio show that I was on,
He says, well, everything in there reflects what Friedman has written in his books. And he gave me credit. He says, in a sort of strange way, after he got out of industry in 1970, all Friedman did was write UFO books, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Didn't come out until 1992. That took a long time to write, I guess, from 1970 to 1992. He even gave me credit for writing a book about Travis Walton. But it's the way people like him make up things that really disturbs me. For example, he said that Betty had dreams about being abducted, and she wrote them up and rewrote them and rewrote them, and for 2 years, Barney must have heard them until his ears fell off. So when he was hypnotized, he put out information that just was a reflection of what she had written. That's total malarkey. No, she wrote them up once, he heard them once, and that was the end of that. Sat in a drawer. You know, where does the guy come off saying something like that? He says when they were out driving on Route 3, and they stopped, and they saw a bright light in the sky, and then they lost 2 hours, supposedly. Well, they were interviewed by Walter Webb, an astronomer, for 6 hours, about a month after the experience, and they clearly described, as long before they had hypnosis now, clearly described this object with two rows of windows and the beings inside the windows that Barney saw with his binoculars. There were lights on the outside and all kinds of detail. Light in the sky? Where does that come from? You know.
Well, see, now this is something.
Nasty, noisy, negativist.
Yeah, this is something that I sort of get on my soapbox about, because that is a ploy that is used when there is something. It's used in the media when there is something that takes place that's undeniable, but they simply can't admit the reality of it. Now, I'll give you a good example. The Ministry of Defense in Mexico released a videotape, and this videotape was taken by one of their Air Force crews.
Yep.
And this videotape shows objects flying beside the airplane and in front of the airplane and so forth. Now,
yep.
This is a videotape not taken in visible light range. This is a videotape shot with infrared.
Yep.
It was, and I said, as soon as it was released, I came right here on this show, and I said, the spin will start, and it will start almost immediately. And I described things that I thought the media would try to do to try and diffuse this. And sure enough, they did. And you can go on YouTube and still see it, where they the reports in the media here were that the Mexican Air Force crew thinks they saw UFOs. They saw and filmed or videotaped a series of fast-moving lights. No, they didn't see them, and they were not fast-moving lights. They were not even visible. The only way that crew saw them was they saw them on radar and they saw them on infrared.
Yes.
Okay, but the media here in the United States spun it by saying it was fast-moving lights and they thought they were UFOs. There were no lights.
Right. No, as a matter of fact, as I recall, their next explanation was, oh, those were gas flames at the top of oil production places out in the Gulf.
Yeah. Yeah, but the problem is
very rapidly.
Yeah, the problem is that they moved around in front of the Mexican Air Force plane. They moved around behind it with the plane flying in a straight line.
Well, you want the facts, man. That's not appropriate. We're talking about debunking UFOs. The facts are the last thing you want.
Yeah.
It's aggravating. And, you know, as the co-author with Betty Hill's niece, Kathleen Martin, of Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, it really, we did our investigation firsthand. I met Betty and Barney. I've been at Betty's house many times. Barney died way back in 69. Kathleen was close to her for, well, from 61, before 61, until she died in 2004. So that's 40-some years. In the last 5 years of Betty's life, she and Kathleen were very close. I've talked to Dr. Simon. I talked to John Fuller, who wrote the book. I keep asking this guy, Dunning, where did you get that information from, that misinformation from? And he doesn't give any answers. He doesn't reference the books. You know, so you wonder, what is this license to assassinate,
mm-hmm.
the character and facts and data and so forth? And it's aggravating. And you could see some of this on the Larry King Show that was rebroadcast last night with Bill Nye, the science guy, who knew nothing about the subjects he was talking about, but he had explanations. And I got a real kick out of his trying to say, oh, you know, all this talk about cover-up because of blacked-out things in documents. Well, he showed a document where it's the person's address that's blacked out, one line. And that's all there is to this, and of course it should be blacked out and so forth. And fortunately, I had Flying Saucers and Science with me, and I was able to open it up to show a CIA UFO document that it took me 5 years to get, where you can read 8 words. Everything else is blacked out, the whole darn page except for 8 not very useful words. But he was trying to pull something off. He wasn't doing research. He grabbed at an explanation and ran with it. He tried to say in a previous appearance that Roswell, oh, that was just a skyhook balloon. Well, no skyhook balloon had been flown at that time, and skyhook was a huge polyethylene balloon, not a mogul balloon, which is what he probably should have said if he was going to stick with the Air Force. And I tried to talk to him about it when we were there waiting for this last Larry King Show last July, and that's the way it was. It's not the way it was, darn it. We got lots of evidence. And, you know, you want an example, though, of the real attitudes of the ancient academics or fossilized physicists or whatever you want to call them. I was scheduled to speak at the Mary Brogren Museum of Arts and Sciences, a rather intriguing place in Tallahassee, Florida, the home of the Florida State University, which is a huge school, I think 45,000 students when I checked. And they got a big football team, too. The museum was showing a Roswell exhibit. There's an outfit in Texas that has put together an extensive exhibit that you can put up on the walls of a museum, and it had been used in a Fort Myers, Florida Museum of History. And they brought me in to give a couple of lectures, which I did, and which were very well received, big crowds. The exhibit was popular. So the Mary Brogren had scheduled me in, and I was to give a lecture on the real Roswell story, and the next day on star travel, Yes. And I thought everything was going fine. And I had offered, she wondered, the woman I was dealing with, if I would appear at FSU in the physics department. I said, sure, but usually it's the student activities people who bring me in. And they didn't want me there. So, okay, one less obligation. Now, 4 days before I'm supposed to speak, there's a letter in the Florida paper in which a professor of physics lambaste them for bringing me in and a Roswell exhibit. Friedman is a well-known charlatan and a pseudoscientist. Nice words to see in the paper. Well, the head of the museum wrote back a letter which got published giving my background and stuff. I don't know this guy from Adam. I did check. He does belong to the American Physical Society, as I do, too. And then in response to her letter, the head of the National Magnet Laboratory, which is an outstanding facility, top magnetic laboratory about magnetics in the country, certainly, and he doesn't mention my name. I mean, the first guy libeled me, and I haven't decided whether to sue or not. I've got 2 years to decide, so let him. I asked for an apology. I haven't gotten it, so we'll see. The second guy just ranted about pseudoscience and Roswell, and, you know, all kinds of nasty stuff. Now, neither one of them showed up at my lecture. We had overflow crowds at either one. And people bought all my books and stuff. But where do these guys get off with this kind of stuff? It's clear they didn't know anything about the subject. And, you know, I should have been expecting this to happen sometime, I suppose. But a previous one of those 11 hecklers that I mentioned was a professor of physics who did come to my lecture in upstate New York at a college there, and he stood up in the question and answer period, starts off with a great line, "I've never heard so much nonsense in one night in my life." Fortunately, my response was good. I said, "Can you be a bit more specific than that, please?" And he said, "You said that the aliens took Betty and Barney Hill to Zeta Reticuli and back in 2 hours." I said, "Sorry, no, what I said was they were taken on board for 2 hours. They didn't go anywhere." He went on to another, "You said that," and that one was all wrong. And after five or six of these, somebody else in the audience says, "How about taking some sensible questions?" This guy gets up and leaves, and I said, "I'll take your question. Who was that?" "He was a professor of physics." He didn't hear what I said. He had some crazy notion of what I would have to be saying if I were going to say flying saucers are real. So, you know,
well,
there's a strange world out there.
You and I, it's very strange. And you and I have talked, I've talked to you a little bit about the hell I've just been through over people asserting that I said something I didn't say, missing the entire point of what I did say, and then getting all upset when I called their hand on it. And the ones I called their hand on are the ones that wrote to me and said, "I just listened to your show and blah, blah, blah." Well, either they're lying about having listened to the show, or they listened to the show from with their head somewhere where there's no fresh air. You know, but then asserting that I took a position I didn't take, you know. Now, that's supposedly, these people are allegedly inside the so-called UFO community. Now, I'm not going to get into that any more than just to use it as an example. You've experienced I've experienced it, and then we hear people say, it's time for disclosure. We can take the truth. And then you see stuff like this happen, even from inside of the, allegedly inside the UFO community. I don't think people can take the truth because they're not listening.
Well, part of the problem is nobody wants to admit they've been wrong for a long time. Also, they don't want to have to change their thinking. They've got a mindset, and I think that's what's happening anyway. And new ideas, Max Planck once said, a great German physicist, come to be accepted not because their opponents come to believe in them, but because their opponents die and a new generation grows up that's accustomed to them. He didn't say understands, you understand.
Mm-hmm.
And so I run across this, and these two examples were distressing. Just because you hate to waste your time on this sort of thing. And it's one reason I haven't decided yet to sue the first professor down in Florida is that the museum is working with the university on various exhibits, and they got told in no uncertain terms, if Friedman causes a fuss here, we'll forget about working with you.
Mm-hmm.
I call that blackmail where I come from.
Oh, yeah. Well, but academia gets away with illegal stuff all the time. And they get away with lying and then badgering people because they have a DR dot in front of their name, and you're supposed to just believe what they say because they're Dr. Somebody.
Well, if you go to my website at www.stantonfriedman.com, there's a piece on government UFO lies. So it's not only the academics.
Well, that's true.
The government's been lying through their teeth, too. And, you know, you get sick of it after a while.
Now that brings up the question. I mean, you've been at this for a number of years. You're not new to all of this.
Hardly.
All right.
I've been
so,
lecturing for 41 years, yes.
Okay, so here you are. You're a nuclear physicist. You're one of a handful who has actually worked on the development of atomic or nuclear-powered rocket engines. Most physicists have never even seen one, all right? And you've been out there talking about UFOs. You've been talking about space travel and space exploration and extraterrestrials, and so you're used to all of this, and you had to know before you decided to write this book about Betty and Barney Hill that this was one of the big stories that's so hard to refute the facts that those who are debunkers would put a monumental effort into deflating the book. You had to know that.
So. I certainly wasn't expecting that anybody would that everybody would blindly accept what we said, although Kathy has done such a fine job of comparing what came out under hypnosis with what came out without hypnosis, and with what Betty said and Barney said and Dr. Simon said, and comparative analysis of all this stuff, that, you know, the facts are there pretty darn clearly based on the tapes. Kathy has them all, and she's transcribed them. So that's why you wonder about where are these people getting this made-up nonsense from?
Yeah, but I mean, just the nature of the way things are in, you know, trying to bring about any type of information and disclosure about UFOs and extraterrestrials, I think, you know, it's to be expected that the debunkers are going to turn out in all their colors when you start talking about Betty and Barney Hill. So what, as you looked at that, why did you choose to write about this? I mean, what was it about it that said, okay, I'll take all that on?
Well, I'll tell you, it's the case. It's the first abduction case that got any publicity worth talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And many people read the articles in Look magazine.
I did.
And were very impressed. They read the book, The Interrupted Journey, and they saw James Earl Jones in the television movie on NBC called The UFO Incident.
Mm-hmm.
I was a consultant on that. And so this was the story that got many people, the first one that get them interested in something. And because these people are so credible, Betty and Barney, Betty, a social worker, the skeptic I was talking about, never mentioned that Barney was on the Governor's Civil Rights Commission with an interracial couple. They had guts.
We have to take a break. We'll come back right after this with more about Betty and Barney Hill and Stanton Friedman deciding to take on that story. Don't go away. Back, and my guest this evening is Stanton Friedman. Just a quick reminder for those of you who are just now tuning in, because of interference with our phone system on which we interview our guests, we are using the studio line, the one that you normally call in on, as a backup so that we can just have the guest on. We go through this about every couple of years. We go through this. And there's just no other way to do the show, so that's the way it is. That means, then, that it's not possible for you to call in because we are using your phone line. We thank you. I've got a couple of things up my sleeve. We'll see if we can't get that remedied. Stanton, you were talking about Betty and Barney Hill, and we were talking about actually their credibility, their credentials, and they were very credible, very stable people.
Yep.
All right.
I was very impressed with them. You know, when I first met them, And that goes back to 1968. My goodness, 40 years ago. Wow.
Time flies when you're having fun. All right, now, in all that time, was it in the back of your head all those years that you were going to write a book about this someday, or did this kind of come up later?
No, I'd written the first article about the star map work and stuff like that. But what led to the book, kind of crazy, I got a call from an English television company that wanted to do something about them. They were going to do a special, a documentary on abductions, supposedly. And they wondered, did I know a lot? And I said, yeah. And they wondered if there was anybody in Betty's family that, could be used in this documentary. And I said, well, let me check with Betty's niece and see if it's okay for me to give you her number. And I did, and I'd met Kathleen, 10 years ago, more than that, probably. She was very active in MUFON, as I am. And so she said yes, and I let them know. And so they brought me down to Boston, and I drove up to the actual location in New Hampshire. She lives in New Hampshire, and so she drove up too. And we went to the actual location, and which was very useful to me. It's the first time I'd been at the actual site of the abduction. And so they filmed us, the usual routine, driving in a car and here and there and separately and together and so forth. And we were a little disappointed. They didn't seem to know much about the case. And to make a long story short, when the show finally turned up, Discovery Channel in Canada, mind you, the ad in the newspaper said, I had sex with an alien, Stanton Friedman, in this show. Can you believe that? So we got really upset. The show, when I watched it, was absolutely terrible. And, we had never talked about having sex with an alien. Betty and Barney didn't have sex with an alien, but they had somebody on the show, a woman who says, oh, she's got an alien male that she has sex with fairly often, and another guy says he has a bunch of alien women, and it was total crap. and they withdrew the ad very quickly, fortunately. I guess it was on their website. We didn't get any apology, but at least they took the ad down because they realized I was boiling at this point. And the thing is that when I was at the actual site and followed the path that they had followed, it was perfectly clear that there's no way that Barney would have gone off Route 3, a major road, onto a secondary road, and then made a turn onto a tertiary dirt road without somebody upstairs directing him. And, that's one of the intriguing things about aliens, is the ability they seem to have to control our minds and our actions without putting a gun to our head. We're pretty crude. Stick a knife in the back and you better do what I tell you or else. These guys don't work that way. So it made me think over the case, and Kathy and I talked about it. We commiserated with each other about this blankety-blank headline and television show. And she had been thinking about doing a book, and she knew that I had been involved, that Betty had good things to say about me, and because I defended them and published about the star map and so forth. Betty and I were on the Tomorrow Show with Tom Snyder many, many years ago.
Yeah, I remember Tom Snyder.
Yeah, he's dead now, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But he did something very, very special. I've done a lot of television shows. And, it's not always the greatest experience in the world, but, maybe it sells a book or two, who knows. But with Tom, this was in New York. He has Betty on. We were taping the sequence. They broadcast it later. And he does the first segment. I'm in the green room. And I come out, and we're doing segments, so there's a little chance to talk just a bit. I said, nobody who watched that will know that Betty was a social worker and a supervisor in the welfare department. She wasn't somebody who swept the floor kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing he did when we go back on air, I'm in the picture now, is he asked Betty about her background.
Now, not many guys would do that. Then on top of that, we had good discussion. When we finished at the end of all this, our segments, he stands up. And Tom was about 6'7", broad-shouldered, very intimidating presence when he's standing up. Betty is 5 feet tall.
Yeah.
So I very greatly appreciated the fact that he hadn't used his size to intimidate. He asked sensible questions. It was a very good experience. And so we were on, incidentally, because of the television movie. This was to hype the movie with James Earl Jones and stuff. And I'd met James. And there was another thing. I had a connection with that show. I got a call from Universal Studios. They'd gotten my name, as it turns out, I found out later, from the Air Force, of all people. And I was a consultant on the television movie. And so, which seems ironic that the Air Force gave them my name. But
well, it does, because on your website you have a standing challenge to the Air Force that you will debate their best anytime, any place.
Yeah. Of course, they've never responded, and I do give out specifics about what's wrong with their the Roswell explanation in particular. Colonel Weber, whose specialty is disinformation. I mean, you know, the thing, one of the interesting things about all this kind of stuff is that they got the guts to say things that are clearly fraudulent and without blinking an eye about it. A good example is that second volume of the Air Force report on Roswell. You know, they'd already gone through three explanations. First, it was a flying saucer. Then it was a weather balloon, a balloon with a radar reflector on it. Then the third, the fourth thing was the crash test dummies. Oh, that was Mogul balloon in between, and then the crash test dummies. Now, in the first place, Mogul doesn't fit. If you look at the characteristics as described by the witnesses, you look at the timing, the location, et cetera, it doesn't fit. But the worst was the crash test dummies, because none were dropped until at least 6 years after the event.
Right.
And all the crash test dummies, and I talked to the man who was in charge of the program, I don't know why the Air Force didn't. They had his picture from back in 47, from back in the 50s, not 47. And he pointed out to me that all the dummies were 6 feet tall and weighed 175 pounds. And there's no way to morph those into a little guy with a big head.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the Air Force had the gall to put out these two totally false things, time travel for crash test dummies, and got away with it. That's what encourages lying, when you get away with it, you know? It's truly incredible that the New York Times brought these explanations.
Well, you know, the press is not real sharp. The media. When I say something like that, I'm not including each and every person, each and every journalist, but I'm painting with a broad brush. I understand that. But as a general rule, the media is not very sharp. A good example is Roswell, because when they had that called that press conference where Ramey had Marcel spread that debris out and hold it up, and they got pictures of him and all that. Now, the press is there, right? They give them the story that it's a weather balloon. Now, here in front of them is the air intelligence officer for the only atomic bomb wing in existence on the planet at the time. He's the air intelligence officer. And not one reporter said, now, hang on just a minute. How is it, Major, or I guess he was a major by that time, but Marcel, how is it, Marcel, that you're the air intelligence officer for the only atomic bomb wing on the planet, and you don't know a weather balloon when you see one?
That would have been a good question to ask, wouldn't it have been?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know,
his boss, Colonel Blanchard.
Yeah.
They've both been in the Pacific War. You know, the 509th, they're the guys who dropped the atomic bombs on Japan.
And the air intelligence officer doesn't know a weather balloon?
Yeah, I mean, you'd
think it's easier to understand then. I mean, it was 1947, the war was over. You believe the government, I guess. But it is an amazing question of how could you get this stuff here and you can't identify a weather balloon, which kids were familiar with weather balloon. The rancher
sure.
picked up weather balloons, you know.
Well, but see, the media's still not asking that question.
No. And it's one of the 10 PhD theses that have been done, and most people are shocked that there have been any. Certainly the professors don't know about them. Deals with press coverage by Dr. Herbert Strentz. He wound up being dean at a college in Iowa, Drake University. And he had a whole PhD thesis when he was at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern, in which he pointed out the inadequacy, inaccuracy, et cetera, failure to do the job of the press on this press coverage of UFOs for 30 years at that time. And it hasn't gotten much better. There were exceptions. You got people like George Knapp, who occasionally does coast-to-coast radio. Now, he's a real journalist from Vegas, dealing with corruption in Vegas. I mean, everybody knows there's no corruption in Vegas, but he's covered that story. And you got Billy Cox in Florida, who's got a blog, who has talked to Roswell witnesses. And, you know, there are some knowledgeable people in the written media.
Sure.
The print media, I guess I should say. But it's truly incredible how the major media... Well, let me give you another example that I still don't understand. In 1952, remember all those sightings, Project Blue Book had its biggest year ever, and right over Washington, D.C., radar and visual observations of flying saucers.
Right.
And at that time...
Stanton, I hate to do it. We've got a break taking over. We'll have to get to that when we come back. I'm sorry. All right, folks, we'll be back right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back. We're on Final Approach, and we're talking with Stanton Friedman. For those of you who tuned in late, may not be aware, I got tired of getting disconnected, the telephone line between Stanton and myself. And so we moved over to the studio line as a backup, and there are reasons why that one's a little more difficult to disconnect, and I won't discuss those. I want to quickly clarify something. Earlier when I was talking about people that were writing to me saying they listened to the show and so forth, and I said, you know, that they were lying, I want to make sure you understand, not everyone who wrote to me and disagreed with something they thought I said is lying. I'm talking about a specific three that wrote to me, said they listened to the show, and then got everything wrong about what they were representing that I said. Okay? But others that wrote to me and you simply didn't understand it right, and we've tried to clarify that for you. That I'm not talking about you. That I'm talking about three specific people that really put on their righteous indignation hats and said things that are provably untrue. All right, now Stanton, we went away again, just as you had started talking about something, but we're almost out of time, and I wonder if we could address this.
Sure.
In doing your research for this book on Betty and Barney Hill, because you already had years of exposure to them, did you learn anything, did you discover anything new that you had not known that made you
say,
aha?
Yeah, an important thing, as a matter of fact, was that I hadn't fully appreciated the fact that in the interrupted journey, John Fuller had not used all the tapes. I mean, I had gone to his papers at Boston University Archives, and I saw that Dr. Simon ran over him real hard. He had final say on everything in the book, the psychiatrist who did the hypnosis. But something that Kathy did was quite remarkable. Kathleen Marden, Betty's niece, co-author on the book, she did most of the work. Let's face it, folks, they wanted my name first only because they said it would sell better, and I guess that's a good excuse. But Kathleen had done this comparative analysis that I mentioned earlier, but she also did something else. It's very clear when you go over all the tapes that Dr. Simon, rather than trying to convince them that they had seen a flying saucer and had been abducted by a flying beings on board a saucer and so forth, did everything he could to try to convince Barney that, no, that didn't really happen on board. That was Betty's dream, wasn't it? So Kathy quotes verbatim from the tapes how he was pushing Barney, especially, in the direction of it didn't happen. Now, everybody says all this business about abductions, the hypnotists are just putting words in the mouth of the victim, so-called, and it didn't really happen, and so forth and so on. Well, here we have a case of exactly the opposite being done, where the psychiatrist is doing his darnest to convince the person that it didn't happen. And Barney wasn't convincible, you know, fortunately. Also, Dr. Simon, and I hadn't realized this, was on record, and it's mentioned in the book, as saying that the emotional terror in their voice when they were reliving portions of the experience, he had to stop two sessions, one with each of them. These were done separately, you understand, and amnesia was induced after each one. So they had no way of knowing what the other one was hearing or whatever, telling. Anyway, he had to stop two sessions because the emotional intensity was so great he wasn't sure they could handle it. It was as great as that from any of the shell shock war veterans that he had treated after World War II, post-traumatic stress disorder, we call it now.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was shell shock war veterans. So to see him say it in writing, and I've seen the letter, is quite remarkable. Coming from a man who ran a 3,000-bed hospital to treat the war veterans with this problem. And, you know, we're hearing quite a bit that guys coming back from Iraq, there are a lot of them with PTSD. But here was Dr. Simon, and I've seen the movie. I hadn't seen it before I got together with Kathy on this. Let There Be Light, that he made for the Army, showing how he treated the shell shock war veterans and brought them back to being able to live a decent life. And that was something I hadn't known. And I had talked to Simon on the phone a couple of times, but hadn't fully appreciated all this stuff from his background. And
he actually tried to talk Barney out of the idea that it was an actual event.
Yeah.
And Barney didn't respond to that.
Well, he responded saying, no, it wasn't. It was an actual event, and he wasn't taking this from Betty or anything like that. And, you know, so it was good to see these things, and it's quite remarkable how people will distort the whole case and make up all kinds of stuff. And we show Betty as she was. I mean, warts and all.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, she got very enthusiastic about every light in the sky for a while. Understandable, considering all the pressure. People were coming to visit her all the time. She was being attacked when she wasn't around on radio and television. I heard a radio program in San Francisco saying that they had admitted that this was all a made-up story, Betty and Barney, you know, which is total nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
But this woman was saying this. I called in, and she was saying, well, she'd heard them, and they had agreed that it was a hoax. You know, where does this stuff come from?
Yeah, and then people pick that up as though it's true and spread it, especially in these days of the Internet, They spread it everywhere. And, you know, the internet is the most fertile field of mushrooms that exists because it's got a huge layer of manure all around. And you got to dig through that manure to get down to the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. There are people who cite, well, I read it on the internet as if that makes it true.
Yeah.
It's like that laughable.
Yeah.
It's distressing. But the book, you know, it's different from Flying Saucers and Science, and it's different from Top Secret Magic. And
well, we're just about out of time. Tell folks where they can get this book.
Well, they can get all of my books from my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. Friedman is F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N. If you spell it some other way, you won't get me. And you can use PayPal. You can send a check. There's an order blank there. And there are some DVDs. There's Recollections of Roswell, for example, with testimony from 26 firsthand witnesses, almost all of whom are now dead, of course, and cannot be interviewed again. That's a DVD. And that's listed there. And Flying Saucers Are Real is listed there, another DVD, 160 minutes long. And for those curious about MJ-12, there's a whole DVD there. That's 150-some minutes, I guess. So all this stuff is available. And, of course, you can go to Amazon.com, or you can go to Barnes & Noble, or presumably your local neighborhood bookstore. But what you get from me that you won't get from any of them is my autograph. I autograph all the books I send out.
And well, also, folks need to know that right beside your picture on my website is a link. It says website. You click on that, it takes you to Stanton Friedman's website. So if you try to spell his name and you get it wrong, click that link. It'll take you there. Stanton, thanks for being with us. If you will, stay on the phone with me for just a moment. All right, folks, we made it through it, even though some folks out there didn't want us to. My friends call me Steel Eye, and my enemies do too. You call me whatever you want. Happy New Year, and I'll be back tomorrow. You be here too. Until then, so long, everybody.